Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Pandemic Journal explores the great toilet paper shortage, and also the first one back in 1973. Plus more. I hope you'll stay tuned. By my count, this is New World Notes, installment number 666. A nice resonant number. It was made famous by the Book of Revelation, chapter 13, no less, at the end of the Christian Bible. And I quote, "Here is wisdom. Let him who hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Well, the whole book of Revelation reads like an acid trip gone very bad, so I don't recommend it as a trustworthy guide to living your daily life. The beast, whose number is 666, clearly is Satan. Some fundamentalist Protestant theologians have done the math and calculated that the beast is also the Pope of Rome. I should note that the Vatican begs to disagree on this fine point of interpretation. For about 13 years, I've been kicking myself for failing to do anything with evocative numbers. I could have called show number 38 the 38 Special. By the year 2015, we're up to the mid-300s. I could have called an installment in January the 357 Magnum. I thought of these joke names too late. Today's 666 may well be my last chance. Unfortunately, I can't think of any funny name apart from the number itself. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the show, brought to you this week by Underwood's Deviled Ham, Hell of a Good Brand Cheese, and the Vatican City Tourist Bureau. Today's show is a bit of this, a bit of that, all loosely connected. Let us begin, though, with installment 3 of Pandemic Journal. Fanfare, please. Let us not waste time with trivia, like the national election, or the collapsing world economy, or the mounting global death toll from COVID-19. Rather, let us zoom in on the one key story of most importance to the lives of all Americans at the end of the year 2020. Yes, we now seem to have yet another toilet paper shortage. This is the second or third toilet paper shortage of my lifetime. The number is debatable. Do you want to count this as part of the same shortage that began in March 2020? That was number 2. Or do you want to say that number 2 was over by July and the one that began in November is yet a third one? Either way is okay with me. You decide. The fragility of our globalized, capitalist, everything-for-profit system was amply shown in this year of the pandemic. Even without panic buying, supply chains were terribly disrupted by the virus, often in unpredictable ways. We began the pandemic with a grievous shortage of masks, gloves, and other essential equipment for public health. You'll recall the unedifying spectacle of the Centers for Disease Control instructing Americans how to make their own masks out of old T-shirts. Paper masks finally became available in stores by mid-June, 3 months later. In March 2020, Toilet paper sold out immediately. Paper towels and Kleenex got very hard to find. Also rubbing alcohol and household cleaning supplies. 8 or 9 months later, alcohol remains hard to find and cleaning supplies are low. Perhaps spurred by popular fears of riots and or fears of a Democratic Congress, gun sales went through the roof this summer. Even now, I am told that the supply of new guns is very low and there is a major shortage of ammunition. Whole wheat pasta was pretty much gone this spring, though white pasta remained in fair supply. Alas, I'm a whole wheat kind of guy. Spaghetti sauce sold out for a few weeks, but then rebounded. The brand of cranberry juice I prefer remains missing in action. Wasabi sauce vanished about the time my old bottle ran out and has not seemed to return. Dishwashing liquid got scarce, and unscented dishwashing liquid vanished for a time. With recreational facilities closing, bicycle sales took off. But these days, American bicycle companies are offshoring their production to Asia, and the flow of new bicycles from Asia to the U.S. pretty much stopped. The owner of my friendly neighborhood bike shop said a few months back that all of his business now is repairs. He couldn't buy a new bike for love nor money. But of course, parts for repairs are also made in Asia, so we'll see what comes next. My heart leapt up this spring when I saw children riding bicycles again, families bicycling together. I hadn't seen many kids on bikes for about a generation. Months later, one sees less of that, now that the weather is getting cooler. Or perhaps the bike shops ran out of spare parts. The takeaway here is that the whole system is enormously globalized, enormously fragile, and not at all resilient. By the way, medical care, hospitals, and pharmaceuticals are run on the same for-profit, low-resiliency plan as spaghetti, bicycles, toilet paper, handguns, and other consumer goods. It doesn't take much to disrupt the whole system. A dock worker strike in San Francisco, a change of government somewhere in Asia, warehouse workers getting sick in Chicago, that's all it takes to seriously disrupt the system. And a global pandemic really disrupts everything. But let us focus on toilet paper. That commodity disappeared early in the pandemic. The New Yorker magazine, in its customary tone of bemused superiority, offered a Freudian explanation for the disappearance of toilet paper. To wit, insecure Americans were panic buying toilet paper because, you see, control of one's feces is a marker of maturity and power. And the pandemic made Americans feel infantilized and powerless overall, and blah, 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 blah. A simpler explanation is that Americans know how fragile the consumer goods supply chain is. And of all the quasi-necessities of modern life, toilet paper is one you cannot make yourself. Not with Sears Roebuck bankrupt. In his newsletter, singer David Rovix offered an elegant solution based on his extensive travels in Europe. The solution is a pointy-tipped plastic squeeze bottle, the kind restaurants used to use to serve ketchup and mustard. Make a note of this. You may need this advice in the near future. How well the squeeze bottle works, I cannot say. I stocked up on toilet paper when it returned this summer. Showing admirable resourcefulness, my local small chain supermarket ran out only briefly. Then they obtained a good supply of odd brands, including commercial-grade Cottonelle, made in America for the Mexican market. It works just fine, and a roll lasts about 3 times as long as a standard American consumer roll. But I'm used to toilet paper shortages. I remember well the great toilet paper shortage of 1973. Most people I talk to draw a blank on that one. Let me tell you about it. There were several supply chain disruptions in the early 70s, too. The biggest one was the gasoline shortage. The Arab state members of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, was trying to pressure the U.S. to revise its pro-Zionist, anti-Palestinian policies. Most of OPEC placed an embargo on oil exports to the United States. The U.S. corporate press never mentioned the political motives behind the embargo. It was easier just to damn all Arabs everywhere. That trick worked again 30 years later, in 2001. How much of the oil shortage was actually the fault of the oil exporters, and how much was the fault of the U.S. oil companies, that is still not entirely clear to me. Certainly the OPEC embargo didn't help. In any case, the U.S. suffered a very inconvenient gasoline shortage. At the same time, for some reason, there was also a beef shortage, along with high meat prices. Not to mention high inflation. Yes, the early years of Richard Nixon's presidency were as much a bummer as, well, all the rest of Nixon's presidency. Then an obscure congressman from Wisconsin named Harold Froelich warned that a possible toilet paper shortage could conceivably be added to the actual gas shortage and meat shortage. That claim didn't get much traction, but joke writers for the Johnny Carson show saw it and removed the possible and the conceivably. Now, the late-night Johnny Carson TV show had around 20 million viewers. On December 19, 1973, about 30 seconds of Carson's opening monologue was jokes about America's supposed toilet paper shortage. Let's have a listen, but first this quick note. Carson's sketch ends with a joke about Mrs. Olson. This was a character in commercials for Folgers Coffee. Apparently, none of the younger housewives in town had ever been able to brew a decent cup of coffee. Mrs. Olson is always reaching into her shopping bag, pulling out a can of Folgers, and saving the day. Here's Johnny Carson.
Here's a interesting item, and it's kind of funny, but it's kind of tragic in a way. Of all the shortages we have, there's a gasoline shortage. You know what else is disappearing from the supermarket shelves? Toilet paper. Ha ha ha, you can laugh now. There is an acute shortage of toilet paper in the good old United States. We gotta quit writing on it. But I wanna tell you, it is serious. I just saw a commercial where... I know it's coming. Where Mrs. Olson comes in with a shopping bag, and the housewife says, forget the coffee, just give me the shopping bag. I want to tell you.
Of course, in 1973, shopping bags were made of paper. Now, Americans were never good at telling buffoonery from truth, so they panicked and immediately bought up every roll of toilet paper available for sale. And that panic buying caused a real shortage of toilet paper. As I recall, the 1973 shortage lasted only a few weeks, for there was no supply chain problem except at the far end. As for today's shortage, who knows? Honesty and transparency have never been part of any corporation's consumer product marketing strategy. Don't worry, the capitalist marketers are rushing into the breach, so to speak, with a high price alternative. high-end, high-tech bidets and combination bidet toilet units. According to the marketers, for a large fistful of dollars, you can once again make defecation the high point of your day. Just like when you were two. Here is some breathless prose from my local newspaper. The headline reads, "A bidet is the perfect gift for that special person." I will read excerpts. Looking for an original gift for that extra special person this holiday season? This year, go for something that can elevate their personal care routine. Bidets can offer the perfect gift for every person on your list. They come as seats as well as standalone appliances, and they come with a variety of features so you can find the perfect match for each person on your list. To inspire you, here are some examples. The wellness enthusiast. For the one who's committed to be their best, a bidet seat is a thoughtful way to get them exactly what they're looking for. Choose a model with adjustable water temperature. Right away, they'll love how much cleaner, fresher, and confident they feel. The technology buff. Shopping for the tech enthusiast on your list can be intimidating. But the secret to choosing the right gift is understanding that the best technology serves and anticipates the needs of the human that uses it. The Washlet S550E by Toto is packed with such features, such as a sensor-activated lid, warm water spray with massage features, adjustable warm air drying, and auto-flush technology. The wand even cleans itself. The Influencer. For the one who lives for being a connoisseur, here is a gift that will crank the luxury vibes in their bathroom all the way up to 11. The NeoRest NX1 by Toto offers the epitome of intelligent, high-lux personal care. Its sophisticated silhouette is inspired by the natural beauty of pebbles shaped by water over time, and its human-centered features elevate personal care, creating the incomparable luxury bathroom experience. Now that you know the gift-giving possibilities of the bidet, shop for everyone on your list by visiting washlet.com. You'll note that, in typical American fashion, the bidet's potential contribution to enjoyable sex for your partner is entirely ignored. Perish the thought. So let us return to anal hygiene. And for those of you who don't care enough about your dearest friends to give the NeoRest NX1 by Toto, there's an inexpensive, no-plumbing alternative. The pointy-nose, squeezable, refillable ketchup and mustard bottles, endorsed by David Rovics himself. Ask for one at your nearest dollar store. You could give one of them to everyone on your shopping list without breaking the bank. As for myself, I have a couple of empty pint-sized bottles from Dr. Bronner's 18-in-1 peppermint liquid soap, which should serve almost as well as the pointy-nosed ketchup bottle, plus a good stash of toilet paper I bought when the getting was good. I don't mean to gloat. It's just that by the third time you suffer some indignity, a divorce, a colonoscopy, a toilet paper shortage, an insane president, whatever, by the third time you no longer panic. You find yourself saying, "This too shall pass." Or at my age, "This too shall pass if I manage to live through it." From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, wrapping up installment number 3 of Pandemic Journal. Good night, Kimberly. Good night, Clark. And good night, Mr. Whipple, wherever you are. Time is short, so let us hop on over to our final segment of installment 666. This is a rare optimistic talk by journalist Chris Hedges, released in early 2020. It's called The Power of Human Kindness.
I studied Arabic 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, with my Palestinian professor, Omar Atman, in Jerusalem. We met in my house on Mount Scopus, overlooking the old city every morning. He would arrive with his books and something from his garden, olives, peaches, apricots, or a bag of pistachios. He would patiently unshell as we worked, and then push towards me. Yom fil mishmish, we would say, as we ate his apricots, literally meaning, tomorrow will be good times, and we will eat apricots. But given the long tragedy that has befallen the Palestinians, this phrase has converted into a wistful, tomorrow will never come. Omar, a polyglot who spoke German, Hebrew, and English fluently, and who had worked as a teacher in the court of King Hussein in Jordan, was determined I would not only learn Arabic, but the politesse and formalities of Palestinian society. He drilled into me what to say when someone offered me food, Islamu idek, may God bless your hands, or when a woman entered the room, and now what al bayt, you light up the house, or when someone brought me a small cup of sugary Arabic coffee, kahwe daime, a phrase that meant, may we always drink coffee together in an occasion like this. Omar had a fondness for the Lebanese child singer Remy Bondeli, a fondness I did not share, but on his insistence, I memorized the lyrics to several of her songs. He told long, involved, shaggy dog jokes in Arabic and made me commit them to memory, although sometimes the humor was lost on me. It was armed with this cultural and linguistic fluency that I first reported from Gaza, carefully removing my shoes before entering the cramped, concrete hovels in Palestinian refugee camps, hovels that on the inside were always immaculately clean. When a plate of rice or coffee was brought to me, I responded with the politesse Omar taught me. The fact that I had taken the time to learn to be polite melted even the most suspicious of hearts. It immediately opened the door to friendships that would last years. In March of 1991, I was in Basra, Iraq, during the Shiite uprising as a reporter for the New York Times. I had entered Kuwait with the Marine Corps and then left them behind to cover the fighting in Basra. I was taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard, who in the chaos, whole army units had defected to join the rebels, had ripped their Republican Guard patches off their uniforms so as not to be identified with the regime of Saddam Hussein. I was studiously polite because of Omar with my interrogators. I swiftly struck up conversations with my guards. My facility in Arabic rendered me human. And when I ran out of things to say, I told the long, shaggy dog jokes taught to me by Omar. Perhaps it was my accented Arabic, but my guards found these jokes unfailingly amusing. I spent a week as a prisoner. I slept and ate with Iraqi soldiers, developed friendships with some, including the major who commanded the unit. And there were several moments when, trapped in heavy fighting with the rebels, they shielded and protected me. One afternoon in the driving rain, I was seated in a Pajero Jeep, hot-wired and stolen by my Iraqi captors during the frantic flight from Kuwait City. We had stopped to fill our canteens from muddy puddles. All of the water purification plants had been bombed. The muck and rainwater had already turned my own guts inside out. As I made my way to the brackish pools, I noticed a woman and two small children scooping up their hands to drink. I knew what the foul water would do to these innocents, and in the cold downpour recited W.H. Auden's epitaph on a tyrant as a kind of quiet, unintelligible blessing. Perfection of a kind was what he was after, and the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He knew human folly like the back of his hand and was greatly interested in armies and fleets. When he laughed, respectable senators burst with laughter. And when he cried, the little children died in the streets. I would hear the Iraqi soldiers whisper at night about what would happen to me once I was turned over to the secret police or Muhabarat, something they and I knew was inevitable and dreaded. That day came. I was flown on a helicopter to Baghdad and handed to the Muhabarat, whose dead eyes and cold demeanor reminded me of the East German Stasi. There was no bantering now. I was manhandled and pushed forcefully into a room and left there without food or water for 24 hours. I awoke the next day to the plaintive call to prayer, the Athan, as the first pale light crept over the city. God is greater, there is no God but Allah. Muhammad is the messenger of God. I went to the window and saw the heavily armed guards in the courtyard below. I did not know if I would live or die. At dawn, the women and often children climbed to the flat roofs in Baghdad to bake bread in rounded clay ovens. I was famished. I called out in Arabic to these women, "I am an American journalist. I am a captive. I have not eaten." A mother handed fresh bread to her young son, who scampered across the roofs to feed me. A few hours later, I was turned over to the International Committee for the Red Cross and driven to Jordan and freedom. Where are they now, these men and women who showed me such compassion, who ignored the role my own country had played in their oppression, to see me as one of them? How can I repay this solidarity and empathy? How can I live to be like them? I owe Omar, I owe all these people, some of whom I did not know, the miracle of human kindness and my life. I am Chris Hedges for the Amir Stein Center.
Chris Hedges, wrapping up this installment of New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that you are not alone, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Peace.